Welcome to Friday, the 16th of June, and welcome to KUOW's Week in Review. I'm Bill Radke, now reviewing the news of the week with the host of Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail, Joni Balter, former Washington State Republican Chair Chris Vance, David Goldstein, a senior fellow at Civic Ventures, which is Nick Hanauer's public policy incubator.
That's what we call it.
Yeah, you help it.
Because we won't call it a think tank because that's claiming too much.
I see.
Too much thinking?
You're not that thinky?
A lot of tanking.
A lot of tanking. Chris Vance, still a Republican?
Kinda, sorta, maybe.
We should just put up a tracker, a Chris Vance Republican tracker, you know, where you are on the
and
spectrum.
And it's moving. It's moving.
Okay. It's in play. Let's talk about the news of the week. And our top story is the fact that the Kent man who filed a civil suit against Seattle's mayor has dropped his lawsuit. Delvon Heckard claimed Mayor Ed Murray sexually abused him in the 1980s when Heckard was a teenager. Other men have made similar claims. Murray denies all the claims, but he also dropped out of his reelection campaign. Why did Delvon Heckard drop the lawsuit? His attorney, Lincoln Beauregard, says it's hard to legally fight a sitting mayor. So Heckard will drop the fight, finish his drug counseling and recovery work, and refile the lawsuit after Murray is out of office.
And he feels like he's been heard, knowing that the public has clearly told the mayor that he shouldn't run for re-election. So with that, we see it as mission accomplished as the primary goal.
Mission accomplished? Mayor Murray says absolutely not. He says the dropping of the lawsuit means he's vindicated.
This political effort to end my public career may look like it succeeded, but today I can say to those who are behind this, you were not successful. I will continue to be mayor of this city. I will continue to lead the progressive agenda of equity and prosperity and social justice that we've made the heart of it.
He'll continue to be mayor of this city. Does that mean Murray will try to stay in office? Because he could change his mind and be a write-in candidate. As Murray stood next to his husband, Michael, reporters asked him, are you going to run for re-election?
Right now, what I want to ask is if Michael will let me have white wine on a school night.
And then and we'll consider that.
And I'm going to consider my options.
Considering his options. Wow, what is your reaction, Joni Balter?
My reaction is a couple of things. First of all, I highly doubt that this gentleman will refile his case.
Why is that?
Just because. I mean, if you have a case, this whole bit about I don't want to go against a sitting mayor, excuse me, that's who he filed against in the first place. And the rest
of it
is...
He's claiming that the mayor is kind of using his power and influence somehow.
I believe they are judge shopping, and that's what they're doing is they don't like the judge they have, and so maybe they'll refile. I'll bet right now that they don't refile. You know, I think this lawyer has run this case just like bewildering. It's almost a case for disbarment. You know, you can't. Our justice system is not set up so that you get to pick the judge you want. You get to pick the exact timing you want. These cases are put on dockets. You know, here's the timing of it. It's not up to you to do that. I have no idea if Ed Murray is going to, you know, file as a write-in. Write-ins are very difficult. They're tricky. We do have a history of some folks actually prevailing with a write-in. This primary is so incredibly close that anything's possible. It's not likely that Ed Murray would come through a primary, but it's possible. It's possible for several of them to come through.
David, you think Murray running for re-election as a write-in candidate would be a bad idea?
I think if he cares about his legacy, it would certainly be a bad idea in the primary because he could end up upsetting the apple cart in a way that some candidates he doesn't want end up coming through.
How would that work?
Well, there are so many people in this race. If you look at 8 years ago, the way McGinn and Malahan got through with this large field, this is an even larger field. So whoever gets through this primary is going to get through with a very small percentage of the vote in an August election. So it's a fairly small electorate. Now, where it might make sense for him to run as a write-in would be in the general, depending on who gets through the primary, who gets through the top two.
That's what a write-in candidacy is. He can run in the general election.
So you
skip the primary.
You can imagine if Mike McGinn, who he hates, gets through. And
has he told you he hates Mike McGinn?
Oh, you don't. He doesn't need to tell me. You can see it. That was a very nasty campaign 4 years ago. So you could see if Mike McGinn got through and if, let's say, Nikita Oliver got through, Ed running as a write-in in November, well, he could get some labor endorsements. He could get the Seattle Times. He could get a lot of support from the business community. But in the primary, I think I don't really think he has a
But he does need there. He does need more votes in the general election. It's sort of an easier math equation in the primary.
Chris Vance, you've been a state legislator. You've been a King County Council member. You know a little something about elections.
I've run 11 times myself. Yes.
Uh-huh. Oh, and?
This is one of the sleaziest, most disheartening, terrible things I've ever seen in politics, because it's pretty hard to come to any other conclusion other than this lawsuit was intended to drive the mayor out of the race, and it did succeed. And that is just wrong. It's antithetical to our democracy. And the problem here is now there's a bunch of stupid, sleazy people out there watching this who think this is how American elections work. You file some sort of specious lawsuit and drive your opponent out of the race. Threaten them with personal bankruptcy by doing it.
Well, wait, what's your evidence that it's a specious lawsuit or that the motive is to drive somebody out of office and then drop the lawsuit?
They said it, that their mission accomplished. Ed Murray will not run for office. And this is bad because there's already too many people out there that think politics is espionage, that politics is about destroying the other guy personally. Politics is supposed to be about debating ideas and philosophies and ideologies and qualifications, not personal destruction. This is terrible. So I really blame the people who filed this lawsuit, but also Ed Murray did us a disservice. If he's innocent, he should have stood and fought and filed, and now I hope he runs as a write-in. I think, having run a lot of campaigns, the reason third-party candidates and write-ins fail is they have no name familiarity and no money. He has both. He's got over $400,000 in the bank. He's the kind of person that actually could run as a write-in, and if he's innocent of these charges, I hope he does.
The other thing is, of course, that on write-ins, all you have to do is spell the name right. And, one of our examples of who ran and succeeded as a write-in is Lisa Murkowski of Alaska.
And Linda Smith.
Well, there's another reason.
Shama Sawant. You don't even need to spell the name right.
And there's another one. And, Murray is an easy name to write in there. I find myself agreeing with at least some of what Chris Vance said.
What about the specious lawsuit part? Let's say that and we have no idea what happened, if this man, Delvon Heckard's telling the truth, what would be wrong with his thinking that this person shouldn't be in office? Again, I don't know the facts, but if that's his idea, what's so specious about that?
I don't know what happened, but I take everybody here at their word. The mayor said he's innocent. And the people that filed the lawsuit said they did it to drive him out of the race. They said it. Okay.
So his opinion is that this person doesn't deserve to be the mayor of a major city,
That's not how you use our criminal justice system, exactly. And it is a disservice to our political system.
And I'll just add, we have a presumption of innocence here, but the way this story rolled out, the way this lawyer conducted himself, this was all tied up here right before filing, how convenient. And so I don't like the precedent. I agree with Chris on that. You can just knock someone out. Now, if you have a great case, stick with it. You don't have to love the judge. You don't know how it's going to play out. If you have a great case, charge on through and don't say, I don't like the timing. I don't like the judge.
Yeah, I don't know that it's a specious lawsuit, but it is likely unwinnable. And there's a difference there.
Why unwinnable?
Because this is a he said that occurred 30 years ago. And be fair, I think it's possible that whatever the facts are, there's multiple truths. It happened such a long time ago that that Ed and his accusers may very well honestly remember things differently. It happened our memories are not these solid things. They change over time. So they both could be going into this honestly, and we'll never know the facts. So it's hard for a jury to rule in favor of one side or the other in a case like this.
Chris, you were evoking the idea that this is not how we are supposed to treat political actors in a democracy. Are you making a connection that some people are making to a topic we're going to talk about in a minute or so, the environment before this shooting in Washington, D.C.?
Well, yes. I mean, not directly. And this sort of thing has happened for a long time. And there's always been too many people who thought that politics is about hiring a private investigator and dumpster diving and looking through your opponent's garbage and finding things. It's not. It is not about that, at least not supposed to be. But the atmosphere we live in today is the worst I've ever seen it. It's the worst since the beginning of this democracy, back when Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson really did believe each other was trying to destroy our democracy. And the relationship back then between the Federalists and the Republicans was violent. And that's what it is today. The Gulf now is growing wider and wider. I blame both sides. And it is a threat to democracy itself.
Okay,
and
hang
people
on.
Ought to be scared to death.
We're going to talk more about partisanship and violence in a moment here. Finally, just to wrap up the Mayor Murray situation. So this lawsuit is being dropped by the civil lawsuit accuser, Delvon Heckard. The King County election rules are that Ed Murray can be an undeclared write-in candidate, either in the primary or the general, and that for the votes to count, the spelling has to be completely accurate. We were asking all kinds of questions. What if people wrote in Ed versus Edward, and there's all kinds of details that they're looking
into? I don't think that's true. I think it's a voter intent state. That happened with the Chama Sawant write-in, where they looked, and if it was clear that they meant her, it didn't matter how they spelled it.
Okay.
He's right. I served on the canvassing board twice as a member of the county council. You literally look at the ballots and discern voter intent, and that's correct.
Okay, good. Glad we cleared that up. So we'll keep following that story, and we're going to get at not just the shooting this week, but the idea of a Seattle income tax, what we're going to do with high earners' money, what Jeff Bezos is going to do with his money, and more. So stay tuned. KUOW's The Record. We are tweeting this program at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. We are with David Goldstein, senior fellow at Civic Ventures, a progressive policy incubator. Joni Balter, former Seattle Times columnist, now hosts Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel. And Chris Vance, former state lawmaker, King County lawmaker, state Republican Party chair. And let's stay on politics of a kind, because congressional Democrats and Republicans came together last night in their annual charity baseball game. The players knelt and prayed together at second base, which would have been occupied by Louisiana Congressman Steve Scalise. Scalise was shot this week in an attack on the Republicans' baseball practice. David, what's the lesson from that shooting?
The lesson is we need more responsible gun policy. We need more responsible gun laws. In the end, it was the gun that did it. You have a Congress that backs the president in making it easier for the mentally ill to buy guns. That very day, we're planning on holding hearings on a bill that would make it easier to buy guns with silencers. And the fact is, we have a public health crisis in this country with gun fatalities and injuries, mass shootings, suicides, etc. We need to be more responsible with guns.
So the cause is immaterial. The politics are relatively immaterial. If this guy had walked up to the third baseman and stabbed him because he was a Republican, what?
Well, you had that stabbing on the subway in Portland, which was, yes, you have all of this violent rhetoric, and I'd say mostly coming from the right. It's not exclusive, but it's mostly you've got this president whose son says that liberals aren't people, who says he could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and not lose any votes.
Well, just on the liberals aren't people, this was, you're talking about Eric Trump.
Yeah.
He was talking about people who are pursuing the investigation against his father, and this is what he said.
I've never seen hatred like this. I mean, to me, they're not even people. It's so, so sad. I mean, morality's just gone. Morals have flown out the window. We deserve so much better than this as a
You're
country.
Right.
That really seemed like inflammatory rhetoric to toss that
it's
off.
It's all part of the context. Look, I don't want to go all Godwin and take us back to the 1930s, but this is how it starts. You go and you say that your opponents are not people. They are less than human, and then anything goes. But regardless, anything can't go as easily as this shooting went if it wasn't so easy to have guns. This was a man with a history of domestic violence. And we know for a fact that many of the mass shootings in this country come from men with a history of domestic violence. Domestic violence should be something that disqualifies you from gun ownership.
Well, actually, we did talk this week to a domestic violence expert who was making the same point and saying that we get distracted by that a huge number of shooters have a domestic violence background. But I want to turn to Republican Chris Vance. How do you react to David's take on what the shooting is about?
I'm going to ignore David's take because that's what always what happens is instead of talking about why something happened, people want to talk about the tool that was used, and I'm just not going to go there. But these Republican members of Congress were targeted because they were Republican members of Congress, and that should just horrify everyone.
Now, we think that the shooter may have asked somebody before the shooting, are these Republicans or Democrats? Yeah. It's not totally 100% sure that was the shooter speaking, but you could see his Facebook feed, and he was very anti-Trump.
I think the motivation is pretty clear. And he was obviously disturbed, and he had a violent history, but this is part of, I think, the overall problem we face today is the rhetoric is completely out of control. And it is on both sides. Neither side here's hands are clean. The right just spent 8 years demonizing Barack Obama, claiming he wasn't even an American citizen. And that's really what happens is, again, as I said before, instead of debating ideas.
And that wasn't most of the right, was it?
Pretty
much. Saying he was not
a whole lot. And if he isn't a non-citizen, he's a Muslim. And if he's not that, he's a socialist. Today we attack each other's legitimacy rather than each other's ideas. Legitimacy is the core foundation of democracy. Why do we pull over for a police officer when we see the lights? Because they have legitimacy. They have the authority to make us stop. Why do we accept that somebody is the president or a member of Congress or governor? Because we trust our electorate. The very legitimacy underlying our system is under attack in multiple ways. And this is the ultimate manifestation of it, where somebody grabs a rifle and starts shooting people. Everyone and every political leader out there needs to step it back, calm down, start talking about ideas rather than attacking each other personally. And I feel like I'm saying that and it's not going to happen. Both political parties are mad. They're insane. They're out of control. And the tribalism is like I've never seen it. And something new has got to emerge.
So, Joni, we're talking about partisanship here, but if this man had been a Muslim, wouldn't he just be called a terrorist who hated our freedoms and was radicalized online, with all of which you could say about
this
guy?
Yeah, we do that frequently, and I'm not going to—
If it's true.
I'm not going to ignore either of my radio colleagues here because everyone's making the right point. This is a gun story, and this is a political rhetoric story, and both are things that this country, we're becoming numb to, because we don't have a grip on either. And that is what we need to get our act together on. I mean, we could sit here and say, well, the Democrats said this and the Republicans said this. The rhetoric has been ramping up to boiling point here for maybe 10 or 20 years, if you think about it. The president isn't immune from any of this either. He uses some pretty harsh rhetoric during the campaign. This language of talking about Hillary, because he gets pretty animated still talking about Hillary. If she gets to pick her judges, nothing
Lock
you can
her
do,
up.
Folks.
Lock
well,
her
that,
up.
Nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is. I don't know. And lock her up. Exactly. I mean, there has been some heat that is just disgusting, and everybody needs to turn it down.
David, on KOW's Facebook page, there were some calls for peace and understanding, but there were a lot of people saying, essentially, Scalise got what he deserved because Republicans are pro-gun rights. Is that over the line?
Of course that's over the line. This is, look, one can imagine things falling apart in this country so far where political violence is justified. You have to have that imagination. It's happened in other countries, but we're not anywhere near there right now.
I think we are.
Where it's justified?
No, it's justified. Where a lot of people believe it is.
Well, you know, but this, again, Joni's right. This has been going on for a long time. Remember, it was George W. Bush who said, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists. That was an effort to delegitimize opposition.
No. That specific speech talked about foreign governments were either with us, and he was talking about countries that were harboring terrorists. You're wrong.
Well, I'll tell you, I got into political blogging during the Iraq War, and I can tell you how vicious the comment threads and the emails were.
Well, don't read comment threads.
Yeah, can we assume that online comment threads are going to be vicious?
They are. They are by definition, unless you go in there and host those conversations and say, hey, There are adults here, so let's stop being like that. Well, but you write some vicious stuff yourself.
That's right, because I don't believe in tying my hands behind my back in a political battle, and it is a political
vicious
battle.
Is a strong word. You write vicious things?
No, I don't think I write vicious. I write, but there's times where I understand if people think it's mean, but I'll tell you what, it's always truthful.
It's helpful if you make the phone call to find out if it's truthful. I'll just add that.
And again, the thing is, you know, and I've been doing this my entire career. I don't think I've ever attacked an opponent personally, ever, and I won't. I go after the other side's ideas forcefully, but people now, for the past 20 years or so, on both sides, go after people personally and delegitimize the fact they even have a right to speak, and it is metastasizing into what it is. The left and the right should debate ideas, not attack each other's morals and ethics and their right to even be here.
David, are you defending going after people personally? I don't know what we're talking, what words you've used that we're talking about.
Well,
I've
written about people's personal scandals when I was a political blogger. I've done that. It wasn't my favorite thing to do. I'm a policy wonk. That's why I work where I'm working now. I'm a policy wonk. But I'll tell you what, Joni, the reason why people knew me as a foul-mouthed muckraker was that those were the only stories that the mainstream media picked up. They didn't pick up on the policy stuff. I've been writing, and we can talk about this later in the show, I've been talking about our revenue problems in this state from the very beginning. But that doesn't get any coverage. What gets coverage is if you break a story about a candidate who hits his mother or who sexually harassed an employee of his. That's what makes the front page. That's not my fault.
Okay, let's end with President Trump's reaction to the shooting, which he says could unite us.
Steve Scalise took a bullet for all of us. And because of him and the tremendous pain and suffering he's now enduring, and he's having a hard time, far worse than anybody thought, our country will perhaps become closer, more unified. So important.
Who thinks we're going to become closer and more unified?
Well, I think one thing that happened is that less than maybe 24 or 26 hours after this, the president is the person who could unite us if he would become less of a vulgarian and more of a dignified president. He began attacking Mueller and Ron Rosenstein, and it just like he could only adopt this tone for it was either 24 or 26 hours. It certainly didn't last. He needs to lead us, and he needs to become more respectful of everybody around him.
Yeah, I don't believe that's going to happen. I don't think he has it in him, but. What could happen, and I don't think it will, but it should and it could, is that the congressional leadership sit down and say, you know, we're going to be lawmakers again, and we're going to like negotiate health care, and we're going to pass a bill that is right down the middle. We're going to compromise. Democrats are going to get half of what they want. Republicans are going to get half of what they want. The far right will vote no. The far left will vote no. We're going to go to the center and work together. That's what ultimately happens every session in Olympia, for instance. But they seem incapable of that in Congress. And if they did that, that would cool things down. But I don't believe they're capable of it.
Can I say what day I think that might be? So right now, Trump's disapproval is around 65%. And when it gets just, I don't know, what's the number everybody thinks? Like 70% disapproval. So approval ratings of 25 to 30. Then those members of Congress will pay enough attention because it involves them.
If they just did what I described, Joni, they'd get obliterated by Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity and the left-wing
media. But who's the audience?
They'll
all be primary.
Your party is pathological right now.
And so is yours.
Well, we're not as sick as that. They can't.
Really?
They can't
really?
Oppose this president. They can't oppose this president because they lose either way.
All across the country, there's battles going on between the Clinton faction and the Sanders faction. You have county chairs in this state on the Democratic Party resigning because of it. Both parties are divided. Both parties have lost their minds.
Okay,
false equivalence.
We'll watch the investigation happen, and we'll look for the becoming closer and the more unified. Coming up in a moment, David, you'll be so happy. We're going to talk about the tax structure.
Hooray!
In this town, in this state. Seattle income tax. How's Jeff Bezos going to spend his income? And goodbye, Ivers. Goodbye, Safeco Field. Stand by. KUOW's Week in Review on Twitter at KUOW. Should Seattle get an income tax? The city council is considering one, a 2% tax on individual income over $250,000. For married people filing jointly, it's $500,000. On KUOW this week, income tax supporter Katie Wilson with the Transit Riders Union said Seattle has a homelessness crisis, underfunded schools.
And the tax code is part of our problem. So here in Seattle, middle class and low income households are paying very, very high taxes compared to people in the rest of the country, whereas the highest income households are really getting off almost scot-free. So what we're talking about here is shifting the tax burden, beginning that process, so that we don't have to rely so much on sales and property taxes that are hollowing out our middle class.
Income tax opponents say high earners would move outside Seattle. We'll talk about whether this is even possible in a moment, but Chris, do you buy that an income tax would keep high earners out of Seattle?
No, I don't think an income tax would keep high earners out of Seattle. I think there's a lot of things that motivate people to live where they live. Suburbanites, for instance, if they want to have a suburban lifestyle, they're going to live as far away as they have to from their job in order to get that yard and the dog and all that stuff. If people want to live in Seattle, they're going to. But, and I'm sure...
City Council, by the way, has outlawed dogs, just in case. We talked about that last week.
An income tax is clearly, clearly unconstitutional in this state. The whole argument is a waste of time, but oh well.
This is because, first of all, the state Supreme Court has ruled that income is property and you have to tax it all uniformly. And the legislature passed a law prohibiting counties and cities from taxing net income. Is there a loophole there?
I don't think we know if there's a loophole there yet, but,
David is nodding.
It's unsettled law.
I think it has been settled. It could be resettled, something like that. I'm kind of in the middle on this income tax, and I know that sounds weird, but the gist of it is it's hard to make the case that Seattle needs another tax. It is really hard to make that case. Yet, you know, this has been festering for so long, I'm sort of intrigued and kind of want to hear what the courts have to say about it. There is a lot of wealth being generated in this city that's not being taxed. So that is an argument that sort of says, oh, okay, let's see what this is really about. But the reason I'm so torn is I don't see how this very flush city needs yet another tax. I'd like to add up all the taxes we've passed in the last 10 years.
How about a different kind of tax? What if the supporters guaranteed, which they are not guaranteeing, but that this income tax would mean a reduction in other more regressive taxes?
Well, that would probably make a lot more sense because we go to the voters, you know, all the time and they say yes all the time and then they wonder why their rents and their property taxes are so high.
So first of all, I want to address that constitutional issue. You've got a case from 1933. Part of the whole point of a Seattle income tax is to get this underlying constitutional issue. Is income property or is it a transaction back before the state Supreme Court? In every other court in the nation, in the federal courts and in all 49 other states, income is a transaction. It is not considered property.
Is there anything special about Washington's
Washington's Constitution. They'll claim it was, and by the way, it was a 5-4 ruling back in 1933. So part of the purpose of this is to get this back before the court so we can address this issue. And if the court says, oh no, income's not property, you can do an income tax, then at the very least, that puts an income tax back on the table in Olympia so the state can address its long-term revenue needs.
So I'm not a lawyer. We should have my friend Rob McKenna in here to talk about this, but when the United States wanted to move towards an income tax, they had to amend the Constitution for the same reason that the earlier courts had ruled that income is property. But beyond that, there is this hypocrisy about what's settled law and what's not. I guess Roe v. Wade is settled law because the court has ruled, and when conservatives try and challenge it over and over again, that's terrible. But the left can keep going after rulings such as on the Second Amendment and on the income tax, and that's okay. I mean, eventually a court has to make a ruling, and that, you know, there's this concept of stare decisis that governs, and you don't keep going back over and over again.
Well, an
income tax is unconstitutional in the state of Washington. If you want to change that, be intellectually honest and go try and amend the Constitution.
Well, so by the way, the Second Amendment, for most of this country's history, the courts did not say that it provided an individual right to bear arms.
But now they have.
But they overturned almost two centuries of precedent to establish.
Can we pause on Second Amendment? I understand there's an ongoing
I want to add something about the income tax. I didn't do this work myself, but C.R. Douglas, who's known to all of you, told me that he did look at the precincts in the most recent income tax votes. And in fairness, Seattle's precincts, supposedly, according to CR, did vote for it.
About 65%.
So that is interesting. You know, I mean, it's not like we would have to have this entire court case. And I say let it rip because I want to know. I kind of want to know.
But let's I want to get also to the underlying issue of why we need an income tax, not just in Seattle, but in Washington state. And that is that we have a long-term structural revenue deficit in Washington state. We've had it for a very long time. It hasn't changed from when the Gates Commission pointed this out over 20 years ago. The problem in Washington is that we rely on the sales tax for about 65% of our revenue. And the sales tax is a percentage of the overall economy has been shrinking steadily for over 50 years. Meanwhile, the cost of providing public services and infrastructure at a constant level generally grows with the size of the economy. So our tax base is not growing as fast as our economy or our needs. And so over time, what we get is the Republican agenda, drip by drip, a smaller government, less public services, less infrastructure, year in and year out. And that does not serve the needs of our modern information economy, where infrastructure, human capital, and public infrastructure, roads, transit, etc., is what grows our economy.
And here I'm going to partially agree with
you. Got a little head nodding from your Republican friend.
Our tax structure and our service delivery structure in this state is antiquated. It needs to be reformed. It's not as simple, in my view, as simply layering an income tax on. There's all sorts of crazy things out there. In King County has one of the most well-funded library systems in the world, but their county roads are turning to gravel because the road fund is underfunded, even though the economy is growing. We need a whole comprehensive look at how to modernize our service delivery and revenue system. My boss, the King County Assessor, John Wilson, is actually working on this. It's not as an income tax might be part of the discussion at some point, but it's not just that simple. But I think
Seattle City Council is saying this is the point. Yeah, that's what they're doing.
What's a better way?
I'm not really even arguing that an income tax is terrible public policy. I'm just saying it's unconstitutional. Just remember that.
What's a better way then?
There needs to be, you know, democracy. We need to have the governor and decision makers and elected officials sit down and negotiate an entirely new system for how we're going to pay for government in this state.
I would say see Olympia for the last few weeks and see how unable they are to pull that off.
Yeah. Just because they can't get it done doesn't mean they shouldn't.
But they can't get it done. They can't meet McCleary with the current tax structure.
That's true.
It is
You're right.
mathematically impossible, and I mean, that is the problem facing Olympia right now.
You could
now
do it with the capital gains. That's an idea, but they can't get there on that either. So.
Or a levy swap.
Well, the levy swap.
The levy swap
is smoke and mirrors.
It
helps address the equity issue, but it doesn't actually increase funding.
That'll be a whole topic as we move toward the theoretical potential of a government shutdown in Washington State as the legislature keeps working on that. So let's pause there. By the way, my favorite Vincent Van Gogh painting, Starry, Starry, Decisis. Beautiful by Justice Van Gogh painting for the majority in that case.
Yes.
We're going to still talk about Amazon buying Whole Foods and what to do with Jeff Bezos' philanthropy and what's going to happen to Safeco Field. What's going to happen to walking into the airport and having some clams? Stick around. KUOW's Week in Review on Twitter at KUOW. I'm Bill Radke with former Washington State Republican Chair Chris Vance, Seattle Channel's Civic Cocktail host Joni Balter, progressive incubator. How about that? David Goldstein. Don't call it a think tank. Okay, let's talk Amazon buying Whole Foods. The national media is calling this a stunning move into brick and mortar retail. It's a little less surprising in Seattle, where we have the no cashier robot store in Belltown and the pickup stores in Ballard and Soto and, of course, the bookstore in New Village. Still, Whole Foods. That's a $13.7 billion deal. There are about 500 Whole Foods stores, which means Amazon groceries are that much closer to customers near those stores. And maybe Whole Foods will have robots. Good news, David?
Well, everything is good news for Jeff Bezos. He's going to own the world. That seems to be his strategy. It's bad news for most of the rest of the grocery industry. If you saw the stock market today, their stocks were plummeting because nobody wants Jeff Bezos to go into your market.
Yeah, so they're Amazon's getting into clothing. You can see that now. And they, you could tell for the last many months that they were thinking, we got to get into that grocery business here. And this is stunning in a way because it's a big jump into that industry and it's going to change it dramatically.
Well, if the future of groceries is online ordering, then Amazon is just the first of many. And if it's not, if the future isn't online ordering, what's the big deal?
Well, we've been through this. We had Home Grocer and whatever the competition, you know, when the dot-com grocery delivery services. I don't know. Personally, I don't know how anybody buys produce online.
Yeah, that's really hard.
Yeah.
One thing I will say, by the way, which we should be wary about is when you look at the competition, particularly in Seattle, all of the grocers are unionized except for Whole Foods. So you've got Safeway, QFC, PCC. These are union shops. Whole Foods is not, and of course Amazon is not. So this could be a blow for labor.
So I'm going to be, you know, Captain Obvious here. I mean, the internet is changing everything, every industry, everything, from entertainment to news to politics to retail now. And that's just going to be the way it is. It's how capitalism works. It's creative destruction. It's the marketplace. My wife was very computer phobic just a few years ago. Now she buys virtually everything online. People like sitting at home on their laptops and shopping online. And then
they wonder where the traffic came from.
And you know? One of the worst things that's going on in the world today is this sort of flat earth, anti-globalist, let's stop progress, let's stop trade atmosphere out there you see on the far right and the far left. This is what people want. It is efficient, and it's how capitalism works. So good for Mr. Bezos, good for Amazon.
Right, I should chime in, though, that disruption is great. The creative destruction, that is where prosperity comes from. But one of the problems that we have in our country is we have this gap between technological innovation and civic innovation. And so we see things like this coming. We see, for example, autonomous vehicles. They're going to put millions of truck drivers and potentially taxi drivers out of work. And we know it's coming, and that'll be efficient. The roads will be a lot safer. It'll be less expensive to ship goods. But we've got millions of people in their prime working age years who are going to lose their jobs. And we see that coming. When we see these changes coming, we have an obligation to actually try to close that gap and have more civic innovation to deal with the consequences, the negative consequences of all of this economic innovation.
And that's true. And, you know, I don't have all the details exactly, but this country spent billions trying to retrain people. You know, people in Ohio and Pennsylvania who worked in factories and stuff.
I thought coal was coming back.
Yeah, we're sending them. We sent them all to community college and stuff. We have been trying to do exactly that, and we should cushion the blow. But at the same time, you know, I'm sure the people who worked in the horse and buggy industry hated Henry Ford, and people who were candle makers hated Thomas Edison. But the world changes, and trying to stop that just makes everything. I mean, it just makes everything worse. We can't do that.
But I don't know who's trying to stop
Donald Trump and Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders and everybody who's anti-trade and wants to like try and make it 1950 again here in this country.
They're not trying to limit Amazon. They're
not yet.
Well,
let's see what the unions do about this.
Well, it's not going to happen in the Trump administration. But at some point, you have to look at Amazon as a monopoly. What I will say, Chris, is that. In the long run, these sort of disruptions, this creative destruction is good in the long run. It increases prosperity. It increases living standards. But we don't live in the long run. We live in the here and now. And when you look at some of these disruptions that have happened in the past, it wasn't just a single generation. It sometimes took multiple generations before working people in certain areas of the country or the world recovered from those disruptions. So we can't sit here and say, oh, this in the long run is good for all of us collectively. collectively, but you here in the Midwest, you are, you know, you're victims of history. Sorry, bad timing. You don't have a middle class
yes,
life.
Yes,
it's not like we could control.
No, this is how we get Trump. This is how we got Trump.
No, it's not.
We allowed these people to be left out and forgotten and feel like nobody was looking out for their interests.
And if we try and manage the economy to prevent innovation and change, we'll make things nothing but worse.
We're not talking about preventing it. We're talking about responding to it responsibly.
Right. And I agree. As I said, we've spent millions and billions of dollars trying to retrain and cushion people and help them through transitions. We can do that.
And I think we'll probably continue to do that. The changes that Amazon into groceries is going to bring about, we will, the society and the educational systems will try to come in there and help with that. That's how it works.
Did you see Jeff Bezos ask Twitter how he should spend his charity money?
Mm-hmm.
Bezos is the only one of America's top five billionaires who's not signed the Giving Pledge, which is not a children's book by Shel Silverstein. It's a pledge that Bill Gates and Warren Buffett wrote to get the super rich to give away at least half their wealth. This week, Bezos tweeted that in business, he thinks long term, but quote, "I'm thinking I want much of my philanthropic activity to be helping people in the here and now, short term, at the intersection of urgent need and lasting impact."
So I wrote
I've been to that intersection, by
I've
the way.
Been to
could,
that intersection.
It could use some sprucing up.
It's a little busy, and it's got a lot of traffic. A lot of those Amazon trucks running by back
it backs
and forth,
up
the delivery.
Yeah.
I wrote a piece for Bloomberg View about a month ago. It was called "Amazon Has Made Seattle Richer and Angrier." And I believe it is, you know, some of the folks I quoted in there, like former Mayor Norm Rice, who said he didn't see Amazon's aspirational goals yet for getting connected to this community or any of the communities. I believe he's been nudged along this way. He didn't sign the pledge that you're talking about. He should have. He should. He still has plenty of time for that. But he does have to get back more involved in this city and many others because of what we're arguing about here, exactly what we're arguing about here. He is changing so many industries, retail, groceries now, books. We all know what happened there. So if he's going to change all these industries, I'm very glad he wrote that email. And apparently it was retweeted like a trillion times because everybody has an idea for how he can spend all the money that is making him, at the moment, the second richest man in America.
David, you tweeted back at Bezos.
I did. I tweeted, first of all, he could invest in passing an income tax here in Washington State. Also, he could put a couple $1 billion into building affordable housing so that somebody other than Amazon employees might be able to afford to live in this city.
So Bill Gates will tackle malaria among the world's most desperate,
right,
and Bezos will help you afford a Seattle apartment.
See, after you know, his business and others drove up the prices.
Right, but
that's more direct.
I actually think he has it backwards. He should be thinking long term. That I think it's a mistake for philanthropists to look at, oh, we have this particular problem. We have people who are homeless or people who are sick. What can I do? I can fund this hospital. I can fund this development. I can fund this program. The problem is we have these structural issues that need to be addressed. And people like Bezos needs to look at the role he played in helping create those problems. Seattle's problem is one of growing inequality. That comes with the wealth that Bezos is bringing to the city. He is part of that. And we have this problem nationwide. It is part of the political problem we have now. Trump and his autocratic neo-fascist regime is a result of growing inequality in this nation. You need to address inequality. And the way you address inequality in the long run is you have to have more of the economy going to wages and less to profits.
Can I just add one thing here? Not to be defending Jeff Bezos, but one of the projects that he has launched recently, providing space and operational stuff for Fair Start, 5 locations, is exactly that kind of thing. It's to take, you know, folks who don't have a big set of skills and give them a chance to rise up. So that is, it's a small step, but it's an important step.
So two things. I mean, first of all, his email or his tweet or whatever it was, I thought it was interesting because it was such a good example of today. I mean, I don't know what he was talking about, that jargon about blah, blah. In the old days, the CEO would just write a gigantic check to United Way and call it good. You know, I mean, whatever. I mean,
he's trying to be more crowdsourcing.
Self-obsessed.
I think he was trying to soften the blow of the Whole Foods acquisition.
And also, I mean,
timing is interesting.
You know, you don't need to go out and make a big spectacle of yourself. Just do the right thing. But the other thing is, I remember a long time ago sitting in the office of Stan McNaughton Sr., the CEO of PEMCO, and I was there to get a donation for a campaign. And he talked about how when you are a CEO of a big corporation, you have an obligation to the community, both your corporation and you personally. You should be forced into it by the government, but to be a good corporate citizen, you've got to give back. And every big corporate CEO needs to understand that. I mean, I don't believe in confiscatory tax levels and redistribution of wealth, but if you're going to be a corporation and benefit from this society, you better be a good corporate
citizen.
Well,
then why would you?
And I'm glad to see Bezos learning that lesson.
I don't see why you would trounce on the method. I mean,
they're just sticking their head
out of the turtle shell now.
I'm making fun of today's rhetoric.
On KUOW's Facebook page, Betsy says, what should Bezos support? His lower tier workers, like those in the warehouses, pay them a living wage. Diane says, how about matching funds for when your employees donate to our nonprofits? Amanda says, legal defense fund for immigrants facing deportation. Michael tweets, disrupt intergenerational poverty by providing housing stability to homeless students. Melissa says, healthcare and education for all Washingtonians. And Twitter's been making much of the whole Jeff Bezos Whole Foods situation. One tweet, for example, this is Jeff Bezos talking. Jeff Bezos, Alexa, buy me something from Whole Foods. Sure, Jeff. Buying Whole Foods now. Jeff Bezos, what? Okay, go ahead.
I won't even notice.
KOW's Week in Review. By the way, I also saw a tweet. Alexa, buy me $13 billion worth of asparagus water. So good. So you said you talked to the CEO of PEMCO?
Long time ago.
Oh, how about PEMCO Field? What do you think?
Fine with me. You know, I mean, are we going to talk about this now or are you going to take a break?
Yeah. I feel like hearing some music.
Okay.
Yeah, that's it. First, let's dispatch Ivor's Fish Bar at SeaTac Airport. It's been there for a dozen years. They lost their renewal bid. The president of Ivor's says he had the cheapest bid, but he lost his spot to a woman-owned small business. The Seattle Times editorialized that Ivor's is a Seattle icon, and the airport authority needs to tweak its concession bidding formula to give more weight to incumbent and local vendors. First of all, for the people listening who just arrived in Seattle, and that's a lot, what's Ivar's?
Ivar's is this seafood bar that's been here for a very long time.
It's an old Seattle thing.
It's an old Seattle. It's an icon.
And it's a day
and
thing.
I don't understand if the Port of Seattle wrote these specs, they should rewrite these specs. I mean, if you can't accommodate Ivar's and the clams and the whole tradition here, then there's something wrong with the specs. You know, if we destroy all that was Seattle, then we really will lose. We need to keep some things that are iconically Seattle, like Ivar's.
Joni Balter, very disturbed by this. Not a bombshell, but clearly a clamshell. David, what's your take?
I think the people are missing the big story here, and that is that there is such fierce competition for restaurant space at an airport that pays a $15.34 an hour minimum wage.
It all started at SeaTac.
And remember, the Ivor's folks, they fought it. They thought it'd be bad for business, and now they've lost their space because other people want it so badly.
Interesting.
So one of the things I do for a living is advise clients and politics and public policy and you know, reputation management. And God, dumb for the Port Commission to pick a fight with Ivor's.
Totally.
The other thing, though, is I've lived here my whole life. I'm in my mid-50s. Ivor's isn't what it used to be. I mean, I remember Ivor Hanglin on TV doing the commercials. And I don't know how many people in the city of Seattle still remember what Ivor's was to this city. You could not have even, you couldn't have even considered doing this 20, 30, 40 years ago. Ivor's was much bigger than it is now.
Yes. Should SeaTac Airport give more preference to incumbent local vendors? I mean, the place is going to Kathy Casey, mm-hmm. who's local. She's gonna open a spot there.
I don't have an issue with that. I just think that once you write rules that oust your local folks who, you know, I like kind of landing at SeaTac, there's Ivar's. I like thinking that there's a bit of Seattle at the airport. I just think that's ridiculous, and the port ought to get its act together again.
Well, the new place is going to be called Lucky Louie Alaska Fish Shack. So you might wonder where you are. Am I in Anchorage?
Sounds like I might. Yes.
A lot of people think Seattle is South Alaska anyway.
Yeah, we're the gateway to Alaska.
Right. And now let's talk about the Seattle Mariners no longer playing at Safeco Field. The 20-year naming rights deal ends next year, and the team says the name will go to someone new. We don't know who. Chris Vance, you helped put the Safeco in Safeco Field.
I did. I was on the county council. I was the chairman of the budget committee when we made the final deals on Safeco Field. I was lucky or unlucky enough to live through both of the debates on Safeco Field and CenturyLink, learned more than I ever wanted to know about sports financing. To make a modern sports franchise work, you've got to have the TV deal, you've got to have the luxury suites, the retail, and you've got to have naming rights. You have to have corporate naming rights. Somebody is going to have to step in and buy this. And we're going to, anybody hoping this just becomes Mariner Park, you know, dream on. It's going to become Starbucks Field or Amazon Field or something.
And I think a combination of Microsoft and Starbucks, so Microbucks would be a good
one. I have a compromise.
Just understand, it has to happen.
So it should be Ivers Field.
Hey, there you go.
And from the field.
And then we'll just know it as the Chowder Bowl.
The Chowder Bowl. That works.
That'd be great.
Yeah.
Bob, on our Facebook page, Bob suggested Starbucks Grounds.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of nice.
Ooh.
Mark, my thoughts and prayers are with you, Mark, because he suggested Crushed Hopes Park. Wow.
Well, there is that.
Season ticket holder. Ian says, name it for your late announcer, Dave Niehaus. And then a colleague saw that and suggested, I love this so much, the UW Orthopedics Knee House.
Oh, there you go.
The Knee House.
There would be so many knee injuries if that happens.
But whatever we do, we don't want to name it Boeing Field because, A, we already have one.
And they'll land there.
And B, they just moved the team to South Carolina.
Ouch.
Ouch.
KOW's Week in Review. That's David Goldstein at Civic Ventures.
And you can listen to our podcast, The Other Washington.
The Other Washington. So it's about we're the other Washington
we're
or
the
they're
other
the
Washington.
Other Washington.
Got it. Politics from the point of view of the other Washington.
Got it. Joni Balter, former Seattle Times columnist, hosts Civic Cocktail on Seattle Channel. You've been getting some great guests on Civic Cocktail.
Like Russell Wilson. Yeah.
Chris Vance, state lawmaker, King County Council member, state Republican Party chair. He's done it all, and he is still
sort of a Republican.
Sort of a Republican. We sort of hope you're going to come back again next week. Join us on Twitter at KUOW, and have a great weekend, and we'll be back at you on Monday with KUOW's The Record.